Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 1:34 p.m. that is Pacific Standard Time. Today is January 18th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, this week we've had a significant rally on Wall Street, and it has finished pretty much on the high of the week. And there is improving optimism about the outlook for a positive resolution to the negotiations between the USA and China on the trade war front. China has at least made an offer that they are willing to balance the trade between the two nations by 2024. The USA wants it done within 2 years. But that's niggling over timetables rather than the essence of the agreement. Of course, the other side of it is that one of the primary objectives of the USA in these negotiations has been to figure out how it's possible to back up any negotiations that are agreed upon with actions that are verifiable. So that's a big point of contention. And then, of course, you have the fact that these are trade negotiations. When we think about intellectual property, the transfer of technology, the opening up of the economy and anti-protectionism or at least to combat the protectionism that China has been engaged in for significant periods of time, well, these are the big questions, and they could largely be sidelined. One point that I find quite interesting is that sentiment is improving rapidly. There is a very clear conclusion that, having been up for four consecutive weeks, that we've seen the worst of it. What I think is worth highlighting is that the S&P 500 has now unwound approximately 50% of its decline from the peak, and it's now approximating the region of the trend mean. This is a condition that is common to a substantial number of markets. So we're at an important juncture here. This is a point I've been making in audios just about every day this week. And we have seen a short-term overbought condition replacing the short-term oversold condition. If we look at a stochastic indicator, it's as plain as day. But that we have this very clear overbought condition. In fact, we haven't had an overbought condition on the S&P 500 since July. So that really is a testament to just how quickly the market has been rising. And it has certainly pushed back above the 2600 point level, and that was certainly the first area of resistance. Now the next question is whether it can sustain a move above the trend mean. There have been parallels between the consolidation that we saw in 2011 and another about the consolidation we saw in 2015-16, and it's worth considering those. But what I'd also like to highlight is that there are parallels right now with what we saw in 2013. And back in 2013, we saw that at the end of 2012, there was a fairly significant decline. We did have a rebound in November, but it faded into the last couple of weeks of the year. But on the first day of January in 2013, the market took off like a rocket, and it went up for six consecutive weeks before pausing for just a little bit. And there was a real feeling at the beginning of 2013 that people had missed the boat. So anyone who had bought at the beginning of the year was well ahead for the year and was in a pretty good position. There was lots of people who did not buy, and they were left waiting, and the market just simply persisted higher. It wasn't really until the end of June that people got an opportunity to buy the dip. Now, what is different today to then? Well, of course, the similarity is the market has gone up now for four consecutive weeks. It's been going up in a steady manner since the 26th of December. And there isn't any sign yet that it has ended. But there is obviously a clear difference in that when the breakout occurred in 2013, it was moving on to new recovery highs. Whereas what we've seen now is a counter trend rally. The essence of a downtrend is a sequence of lower highs and a sequence of lower lows. And that's what we have on the S&P 500. That's why I'm rather cautious about becoming overly bullish. We had a very acute decline, and it was certainly an acceleration on the downside. Acceleration is a trend ending. That was always one of the things David has said, is that an acceleration is a trend ending, but of undetermined duration. And we have seen an equally impressive acceleration upwards. Well, what are the conditions that would break this downtrend? Well, the first would be some higher reaction lows. We did have a higher reaction low in November, but then it failed. So we're going to have to see another one of those. I think it is arguable whether we could really consider one day on the downside on the 3rd of January as being a higher reaction low. The really big question will be whether it can push back above the 2800 point level. At that point, it would be above the trend mean. Then the question is whether it will in fact be able to continue to hold that. Now, the very important point, I think, is what's going on in the background, because what we're certainly seeing on the front page is that the trade war figures are improving, that banks have come through with earnings in the order of 110 billion. They've cleared the 110 or the $100 billion mark for the first time. So in terms of profits, that's really very impressive indeed. And certainly when we look at the banking sector, then it has just about unwound its oversold condition relative to the trend mean, very similar in fact to the S&P 500. But even here we see that there's a rivetingly consistent progression of lower rally highs, which is now being tested. So this really is the do or die moment for these indices. The big question really is not so much in how much further the market can rally, but where is the next low going to be? We need higher reaction lows to demonstrate that people are worried about not being able to pick it up at the prices that they saw previously, that they're willing to step in and pay somewhat more on the next pullback, for the fear of missing out. And that is a clear indication of what people are doing with their money, and it's a reflection of sentiment. We've had a record short covering rally going on in the last 4 weeks. Now, the other thing, of course, that people have been worried about is the Fed's balance sheet. Well, we had some bonds expiring this week. Treasury bonds expire on the 15th and the 30th of the month. So the measure is now down to 4 trillion and change, but it's very clearly still trending down. And that isn't likely to change unless we see a significant deterioration in the stock market. There's very little is going to deter the Federal Reserve from continuing to reduce the size of its balance sheet, for the simple reason that they feel they have to begin to rein in the excesses of monetary policy before the next recession. The USA at the moment is running pro-cyclical policies. So that's a very significant issue, because what if you're running pro-cyclical fiscal policy and monetary policy, then and I suppose it is arguable now whether the USA is in fact running a pro-cyclical monetary policy, because they are tightening, but it exacerbates the peak-to-trough swings in terms of the economic cycle if they're running such loose fiscal policy at a mature stage in the economic expansion. So that's also something we're seeing in lots of other places. It's in large part due to the rise of populism. And populism is a direct response to both to the loss of manufacturing jobs over the years, the rise of globalization, the debt-financed social democracy that's been prevalent in the West, at least for almost 40 years, and then the catalyst of quantitative easing pushed it all over the edge. Because quantitative easing, in one fell swoop, accelerated the pace of inequality. This is exactly what Ray Dalio was saying happened in the 1930s, where you had quantitative easing, or that was the last time we had quantitative easing, and it was also a time of widening inequality and rising populist tensions. Well, this year there are going to be elections in a significant number of countries, and there is the realistic possibility that we're going to continue to see populist governments coming into power. The reason that you get communist gov or excuse me, populist governments coming into power is because people are unhappy with their lot in life. They are, and in today's world, because of social media in particular, the inequality is increasingly apparent and is highly visual in nature. So people are under no illusion as to the condition of their own lives versus people who are better off, and that is quite different from the condition in years past. Well, when we think about some of those elections, another point that David made many years ago was that in emerging markets, governance is everything, and he later abbreviated that and just said governance is everything. And that couldn't be more true. But of course, governance is not a an absolute designation. It's a relative designation. So it's really, and it's of course relative to itself. So is governance more improving or declining? And in India, I think it is arguable that governance is improving, that the Modi administration has made strides in attempting to improve corruption and to try and get the economy into a condition where it can grow. Well, there is the strong likelihood that the Indian Central Bank is going to reduce interest rates, and that is likely to add a tailwind to the stock market, and it is exhibiting clear relative strength right now. And of course, India has got a massive young population. With a population of 1.3 billion people, half of them are under 25. So when we think about the demographic dividend, then India has that writ large. Well, Indonesia also has an election coming up this year, and Widodo has been a stabilizing factor for the economy, and he has also been trying to foster growth, and we're starting to see relative strength coming through in the Indonesian market as well, because there's a likelihood that he is going to win his election. Well, since Rodrigo Duterte won the election in the Philippines, the peso has done nothing but decline, and he's up for election again this year, and I suspect that there is a strong likelihood he's going to win, despite the fact that the suspension of habeas corpus and the execution of thousands of drug dealers is not playing particularly well in the media in the West. It's quite popular at home. So the Philippine Composite Index has been ranging higher over the course of the last few years. And of course, that is being flattered by the weakness of the currency. But when we look at, for example, an ETF, well, then we can see that it's bouncing from the lower side of its range. And more importantly, it has clearly broken back above the trend mean. That is suggesting a failed downside break below 30, and now a rally back up towards the upper side of that range at the minimum. Another country where I think it is arguable that we are getting improving governance, although from a very low base, is Nigeria. And we can see that the market has been very volatile over the last few years, but Nigeria is also a very populous country. It has got enormous potential and a very entrepreneurial population, but obviously corruption has been a huge inhibitor to economic growth over the years, and that isn't going to end anytime soon, but it may get better. So that's a potential bonus for the country over the medium term. Of course, the other big question is what happens with oil prices. And when we think about the outlook for the oil price, well, it's likely to range more than trend over the course of the next decade. We can see also that when it looks like Nigeria is going to do better, Guaranty Trust Bank tends to turn around, and it's been outperforming the domestic market for a significant period. It's also got listings in the UK. Then the other big countries that have got elections coming up are Canada and Australia. Well, the Canadian market is mimicking the rebound we've seen on Wall Street, and in fact, it is doing somewhat better. It's actually coming up towards the upper side of that overhead trading range, but it is approximating the region of the trend mean. And I think it's quite likely that they could have a new government there. The problem for Canada is that property prices are really quite high. Geopolitical tensions are rising, and having an ideology-led government rather than one that is engaged in realpolitik and trying to manage the challenge of slowing global growth is probably going to weigh on public opinion. And the financials sector is also now right back in the region of the trend mean. Well, when we think about what's going on in China, then you certainly have a slowing economy there, and there is the top three countries that are influenced by China's economy are South Korea, Taiwan, and Australia. And of course, Australia in terms of its commodity exports. Well, the ASX 200 is now right back in the region of the trend mean, and it has also been rallying impressively. Well, we can see very clearly that there is a high degree of commonality here in the stock markets. And that's certainly a testament to the bargain hunting that's been going on over the course of the last few weeks. So that's, I think, an important characteristic here. There has been a very impressive rebound going on just about everywhere. And Europe has been lagging somewhat, but it certainly started to play catch up in here today. And there is the scope that it could do better from here. But the other point is that when we think about the consistency of trends, then we've had a major trend in consistency. The things that people are starting to get optimistic about right now are that the trade war may be moderating, and that would certainly be positive. But little attention is being paid to the direction of Federal Reserve policy, because if the market rebounds further in a dynamic manner, well, that would suggest that the Fed will be emboldened to continue to act. It will continue to reduce the liquidity on offer. They will reduce the size of their balance sheet. They may even be encouraged to continue raising interest rates. Well, when we look at the implied pace of interest rate hikes, this is a Morgan Stanley index, we can see that it popped below zero at the end of last year. And it's not updated daily. I think it's really only updated once a week. But it at the end of last year, it was pricing in the potential for one rate cut in the next 12 months. If the stock market continues to rally, this index is going to rise. That would price out the potential for a rate cut. And if it were to rally any further, then people would start to be thinking about the potential that they would indeed go ahead and raise interest rates this year. So the Federal Reserve is going to be data dependent. That's definitely what they've told us. If the data continues to improve, well, then they will continue to raise interest rates. Now, that is not something that anyone is worried about right now because everyone is enjoying this continued rally. We simply do not yet know at what point or what value on the S&P does the Federal Reserve consider to be problematic in terms of policy. So I think that is something that we are going to see more headlines about. The further this rally goes on Wall Street, the more of these kinds of questions are going to be asked. There is the other additional point in terms of demand for equities, and it relates to buybacks. And there was this rather impressive chart I saw earlier on this week. And you can see that the pace of buybacks on in 2018 was completely out of character with what we'd seen previously. There's a strong likelihood that buybacks are going to continue this year, but at a much reduced rate relative to 2018. Then, if it comes back to anything close to 2013 or 16, well, that's going to be a significant source of a lack of demand for equities. Then there is the point that we had a big move in buybacks in 2018, and yet the market went nowhere. What this suggests is that, or at least confirms, is that the market is forward-looking. As soon as the tax cuts had been enacted, the market very quickly priced in the share buybacks. That's exactly what we've seen. Now, the consistency of the trend that we saw in 2017 was a testament to just how much money was going to be spent on buybacks. The quantity of buybacks this year is going to be a lot less, and therefore we shouldn't ex anticipate that we're going to have the same kind of consistently trending environment. If the Federal Reserve continues to raise interest rates, then that is going to have an inhibiting factor. So it is worth looking at, for example, the home builders, because they are very interest rate sensitive. And what I found rather interesting in here today was that having trended down and then popped on the upside last week, they've pulled back really quite sharply in here this week. So now it's right in the region of the upper side of that little range. And if it is going to bounce, well, it would have to be getting about it next week. If we see a failure at this level, well, then we can only conclude that the medium-term trend on the downside is still intact. Then let's take a look at the small caps, because the small caps generally tend to be more interest rate sensitive, and they generally tend to be more influenced by the outlook for the domestic economy. But the other point, of course, is that they led on the downside, and that the commonality that we've seen in small caps globally tells us that the tightening liquidity environment is not so much a US phenomenon or a UK or a European phenomenon, but it's generally a global phenomenon. When we start to look at the commonality that we still have in some of these sectors, well, we've certainly seen a rebound, and that is certainly unwinding the acceleration down. And now the question is how much further it is going to persist. If we spin that out now and look at what's going on in the UK, well, we're presented with a relatively similar condition. And the UK has rebounded from its recent lows and is now coming back up towards the region of the trend mean. In Germany, the MDAX has also been resurgent over the last couple of sessions, but it continues to lag the kind of rebounds that we've seen elsewhere. In Japan, the TOPIX second section has been one of the most reliable lead indicators for the market, and it pulled back in an extraordinarily violent manner in December. So now there is a short covering rally underway, but that's a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. If one knows nothing at all about chart reading and you get a decline like this, then it stands out on the chart, and anybody can look at it and say, well, golly, something must have happened on that week. Well, We certainly know that there has been a sharp pullback, and we know that there have been some serious machinations going on in terms of the yen. Well, the stock market is responding to that strength of the yen, but also to the tightening liquidity environment globally and to the volatility, of course, on the currency. The yen does not look like it, or the Japanese don't want to have a stronger currency, and it is unlikely that they're going to tolerate a yen stronger than 105. And in the meantime, the overbought condition continues to be unwound. Gold also has been doing rather well over the last few weeks, and not least because it's a hedge against strife in the stock market. Well, it was down $10 in here today, and that's the biggest downward dynamic we've seen in at least 2 weeks. It's increasing the potential that we're going to get a reversion back towards the mean, that some of this advance put in over the last few weeks will be unwound. When we look at this, though, on the longer term scale, well, we can see that it has been ranging for nearly 3 years. So it's coming back up towards the upper side of that range. It won't be until gold pushes up and through to the upside and above 1400 that we'll have confirmation that we're back in a demand dominated environment. But one point that is interesting is the dollar remains really quite firm. Whereas when you look at the gold price in other currencies, well, it hit a new all-time high 2 weeks ago in terms of the Australian dollar, and is now consolidating. When we look at, for example, the pound, well, the pound has been all over the place, but it has broken its sequence of lower rally highs over the last couple of years, and now it does look like we're going to get some consolidation. So the message is certainly that when we look at all of these, that it is quite likely gold is going to consolidate. But we are starting to see evidence of people accumulating gold. You had, what's his name, Zell, was on Bloomberg TV today saying that he's bought gold for the first time ever because it looks cheap and it's a good hedge. He's not the only person. ETF holdings of gold are back on their recovery highs. So people are starting to get back into the gold sector. But perhaps not quite yet into the gold miners. Gold miners are at, I think, interesting points here in terms of the cycle. Investment in exploration and development has almost completely disappeared. And that's good news because it's removing supply from the market. And now we're starting to see M&A activity picking up. So people in the investment community would rather, or they're probably finding it easier to raise money to go out and buy a competitor rather than invest in new supply themselves. Because proofing up and developing new mines is an inherently risky operation. It takes years to complete, and then you very often get cost overruns. Whereas, generally speaking, the sector is depressed right now, so it is possible for these companies to buy each other out at levels that are attractive. So that's what we're seeing. But that's not going to increase supply. If we go back and think about the kinds of moves that we had in the and the the ETF doesn't have that much history. Let's go to the Gold Bugs Index instead. And that goes back, it has a lot more history. If we go back and think about the moves that we had in terms of the gold miners at the beginning of the last bull market, they were spectacular on the upside for the first 3 or 4 years, where the index went from a low of 35 to 300 and change. So that was very significant, because what that really highlighted was that we are probably at a position here that that is relatively similar. When you think about the, I'm just going to try and turn off that. Just one sec. I need to turn off Skype. Sec. So that's sorry for the interruption. That's there we go. Sorry about that. When we look at the gold miners, they are at a relatively similar position today that they were back then because we are in a supply inelasticity environment. Of course, the necessary condition is that we get prices starting to turn around in terms of the gold price. And we don't have that quite yet. So it might be a little early to be getting really enthusiastic about the gold miners, but it's not as if they're not depressed. So this is, I think, an under-owned asset class. It's probably one, though, that could go down a bit before it goes back up again. And there is, I think, a logical argument for why gold should be doing better, and it's because we have some significant issues with debt. The debt markets are at a very important juncture, and this is a point that is going to get a lot more attention probably later this year. When, for example, we look at the 10-year Treasury price, it's been trending down for approximately 3 years, and a short-term overbought condition is now being unwound. Well, this has not been a particularly consistent trend in terms of the price, so therefore, we can't anticipate that it is going to suddenly become consistent unless we get a big imbalance between supply and demand. What we then probably are in for is more volatility. But the necessary condition, if the prices are going to continue to trend lower, would be that it sustains a move below the trend mean. And this rally that we've seen has been very meaningful in terms of its size. So we have a contradictory kind of environment here with the bond markets because there is an enormous amount of supply that is coming onto the market this year. If we think about the investment grade market alone, issuance last year was in the order of 50 billion. This year it's more like 650 billion. So then it's going to be 750 billion next year. So these are very big, significant numbers. The quantity of high yield debt that needs to be refinanced this year is not quite as high as it is for investment grade. In fact, that number isn't going to peak for another few years. But the problem, of course, is that the vast majority of investment grade debt is on the lowest rung of investment grade. So there is the scope for a significant quantity of that debt to be downgraded if we see economic growth slowing, or indeed interest rates rising. Now, when we look at these prices, then this is certainly unwinding the short-term overbought condition. And then we have the additional fact that 10-year Treasury yields have bounced from around that 2.5% level, and they are resurgent back up towards the trend mean. And I think that when we look at the potentials here, well, if yields continue to move higher, well, that is going to clearly be a sign of medium-term supply dominance. That's going to result in the federal government running even bigger deficits because they're going to have to pay even more to refinance their debt. And there is an extraordinary amount of US debt is maturing within the next 3 years because they did not take the opportunity to stretch the maturity on the debt during the years of quantitative easing. So that's certainly a challenge. There is, of course, the other point that the US government itself, in terms of its various arms, owns a substantial quantity of the debt, whether that is with the Fed or with the Social Security system. Then private individuals and corporations in the USA and banks own lots of US debt, and only about a quarter of it is held externally. And of those that hold it externally, the biggest holders are China and Japan. So that is one of the points that I think is less considered by investors when they're increasingly becoming bearish of the dollar. The USA holds the vast majority of its own debt, and that puts it in a favorable position in terms of manipulating that debt. So we're at an incredibly important juncture. Now, it was another thing that I saw earlier on this week, and I thought it was quite important. If we start to look at the aggregate of tightening in terms of the cycles we've had previously, well, if you add in the quantitative easing, and then what we've seen is that the Federal Reserve has been raising interest rates, but the stopping of quantitative easing has also been a significant factor. So while the magnitude of the interest rate hike so far has not been all that high, if you start adding in the influence of quantitative easing, then that is going to represent a rather important factor. If we were late in the cycle in December and we're now in January, we're still late in the cycle, but we've had a very impressive counter trend rally. And I think this is going to be the big question. Because if we look at the very simple chart patterns, then we have completed top formations. So that's certainly an issue. Then, when we know that the Federal Reserve has been very clearly engaged, let me just go back and I need to zoom in because this is a very small chart. So when we look at the how much debt is really out there, well, I'm going to just simply pick two of these countries. If we look at the USA, then government debt is the biggest portion, household debt is smaller, and non-financial corporations is about the same as households. Well, non-financial corporations have been boosting the quantity of debt really quite considerably during this cycle because they've been using the proceeds from that debt to pay down older, more expensive debt and then to buy back shares. We've already looked at the quantity of shares that have been bought back just in last year alone. But then it's also worth looking at China. So the first thing is that US debt and is one thing, but Chinese debt is actually higher than the USA's on an aggregated basis. And the vast majority of that debt resides within non-financial corporations. So what are the non-financial corporations that could possibly have all that debt, have a debt load that is larger than that of the US government? Well, it's property developers, it is metal bashers, it's going to be all of those corporations and semi-state and state-owned entities which have got outright support from the Communist Party over decades and have never really had to worry about profitability because they have had successive lines of credit made available to them. Well, if we have to look for one reason why the Chinese are so intent on containing the shadow banking sector, this is it. The total debt to GDP ratio for China right now is 250%. And that's a significant issue. And in fact, since all of those companies are in fact state-owned, the quantity of state debt that China has dwarfs everything else in almost every other country except Japan. So, obviously, you can make the same argument for China that you can for Japan, in that all of that debt is owned by the government. It is, I think, worth taking a look at exactly what is going on in China in terms of government debt. Because we've seen yields pulling back and contracting really quite considerably. Well, that's representative of safe haven buying. And the reason that you have safe haven buying going on in China is because they are weighing so heavily on the banking sector. And certainly they're making more money available to the banking sector, particularly at this time of the year, because one thing you'll definitely see at the beginning of every year in China is that banks tend to get all their lending commitments done in the first 6 weeks of the year. So there is a massive demand for credit right at the beginning of the year, and then it's pretty slim pickings for the rest of the year. So they have a quota system. Well, that's exactly what we've seen in the last few weeks, that the central bank has been making a lot more liquidity available to the market at this time of the year ahead of Chinese New Year, because it's when all of those commitments get made. And we are seeing a bounce in the banking sector, so that's positive. But we're still a long way from a clear return to demand dominance. When we look at the A-share index, it's heavily weighted by the financial sector, and it is just about barely steady. What we are starting to see, though, is that within the technology sector, that some of the companies are doing better, and Tencent is resurgent. It has now got a higher reaction low, and it is back above the trend mean. So there is very clear now evidence that the low is in. That's really quite positive, considering that it led on the downside. And the very fact that Tencent is doing better is likely to shade the perceptions of the emerging markets index. It's the biggest constituent of the emerging markets index, and China represents a very significant weighting within it. That doesn't hide the fact that China has got significant debt issues. They are now engaged in fiscal stimulus. They are going to be cutting taxes. They're going to be making more money available to the banking sector. They do not want to take the pressure off of the shadow banking sector, precisely because their debt to GDP ratio is already extraordinarily high. So that is a certainly something that is going to be influencing their ultimate decision about how much liquidity to leave into the market. Well, when we start to aggregate those the quantity of debt that is outstanding, well, excuse me, what we then need to see is this rebound that we've seen in the central bank balance sheets when they're aggregated going to persist? And that's an awfully big question, because the better the dollar does and the better the US stock market does, the more likely it is that central banks are going to continue to remove stimulus from the market. So we are in the process of passing, or I think passing the baton from reliance on monetary policy to reliance on fiscal policy. There is the scope for an infrastructure deal in the USA, and certainly that would be an additional source of enthusiasm for the market. It could even delay the potential for the next recession. Of course, when that fiscal stimulus runs out, they would have to come up with another. And by that stage, we are going to be into the fourth year of the presidential cycle. I think if we are going to talk about potential bullish outcomes, then what we need to see is that this rally persists, that it when it pulls back, it finds support above the 2400 point level, and then it pushes back above the trend mean. If Wall Street does that, then I think emerging markets are going to be in fine fettle, not least with China continuing to stimulate its economy. Then also you have the fact that the renminbi has not been quite so strong as people feared, and it is encountering resistance, at least in the near term, in the region of its trend mean. The big question, of course, is going to be what happens with the dollar. Well, the dollar index has bounced this week from the region of the trend mean. The US economy remains the strongest performer internationally, and as long as that remains the case, then that's likely to act as a tailwind to the dollar. But for anyone who is bearish of the dollar, then you can't be simply bearish of a currency. You have to be bearish of it relative to something else. And what is going to appreciate versus the dollar? Well, I rather think it's unlikely that we're going to get the euro surging higher. Europe has got significant issues. And the debt issues that are residing within the European banking sector are non-trivial, and they are long-term in nature. Europe completely fudged the opportunity for debt forgiveness and for debt write-downs and recapitalizing their banking sector in a timely manner, and that was very much a political decision, and there is no one doing it now. So eventually Europe is going to go towards a federal system. That is that was the entire rationale behind the austerity, so that debt to GDP ratios could be equalized between the member states. And when that was achieved, then the rationale would be that they would set up all of the cross-funding mechanisms that would exist within a federal state, and bingo, you have a federal Europe. But unless you have equalized debt to GDP ratios among the various states, it would mean that all of the debt would have to be aggregated, and then the creditor nations wouldn't, in under no circumstances, tolerate that condition. So we're at a juncture here where the rise of populism in Europe is something that is going to heavily influence the elections in Europe for the European election in May. You could get a significantly more Eurosceptic administration taking over the European Parliament, and that could have rather significant effects both for the currency but also for the regional stock market. So Europe is has the potential here to do significantly worse than the global economy. If we're really looking for markets that are going to perform, well, then it's likely to be in the emerging markets. It is in countries like India and Indonesia and Brazil, where there is the scope for currencies to at least hold their own against the US dollar. And we also, of course, have an election coming up this year in South Africa. And there is a lot of disaffection in South Africa with the ANC, but quite whether it is enough to displace it or to create the potential for an upset in terms of the election, I think is very questionable. What is interesting is that the rand is now right in the region of the trend mean. So if it can strengthen through it, well, that would be really quite positive for the stock market. It would really start to act as a magnet for investors to get back into South Africa, but it really does need to strengthen through it in order to question the overall downward bias for the rand. So we're at another. This is another market where we're at a really important juncture. The other chart, or I suppose graphic, that I saw this week, I thought was worth sharing with you, is the outperformance of technology in terms of earnings. So It's been incredibly significant during this cycle. Since 2009, the world technology sector has been doing spectacularly well in terms of earnings growth. When we think about what it is that has been driving this bull market, well, the Nasdaq has outperformed just about everything else. It's also now right in the region of its trend mean, and a number of the very large companies, not least Apple, have had meaningful declines. I don't wonder whether we don't need a new CEO for Apple. This is the by far the largest decline in the course of this decade-long advance. There's still a very wide overextension relative to the trend mean, but we're probably at peak iPhone, and it doesn't really look like the company has got a new business plan. What a new business plan could look like is a subscription business model. I think there are a lot of people would be willing to pay Apple a few hundred dollars a year for new phones and access to lots of apps and music. But quite whether Tim Cook has got that kind of imagination, it remains very much to be seen. And if we don't start to see things starting to improve, well, it could be quite easily see a stock or a shareholder revolt against the CEO. Well, it was a change in the CEO really ignited interest in Microsoft, and it is exhibiting very clear relative strength right now. The kinds of companies that are exhibiting clear relative strength are either those that have already adopted the subscription business model, like Cisco and Microsoft, or it's going to be those that are heavily involved in cloud computing. So, for example, VMware is one of the few that has been able to push through to new high ground. When we look at what does a higher reaction low look like, well, it's as plain as day that on the 28th of December, we had a higher reaction low and subsequently a rebound. That's what a higher reaction low looks like, and we just don't have them yet on the major stock market indices. Then, when we look at, for example, some of the cloud computing, other cloud computing sectors, we had a higher reaction low on Salesforce as well. So, that's certainly one of the sectors that could potentially be doing better from here. In the technology sector, biotech has been resurgent and it is closing out the week back above the trend mean. I think it's also noteworthy that it did not quite pull back as much as everything else, and that probably the pullback was more in sympathy with the wider market rather than any real issue with the outlook for the biotechnology sector. The fact that we've had this incredible earnings growth coming through in the technology sector has been largely isolated in the social media companies in search, and certainly when we look at Facebook, it has now broken its sequence of lower rally highs. If we, of course, we haven't yet seen a higher reaction low, but in a downtrend, the lower rally highs are more important. So there is certainly at least some cause for enthusiasm that the worst is over for Facebook. Then, when we look at Google, for example, it is still holding the $1,000 level, and it has closed out the week just above the trend mean. I'm not particularly enthused by the fact that they're opening an office about 600 meters from my home. That's going to push up property prices, and I haven't quite bought one yet, but that's largely beside the point. The other thing that we, I think, have to bear in mind is it's another Fullerism, and it's that monetary policy beats most other factors most of the time. We know that monetary policy is contracting, and that the central banks of the world are trying to rearm their guns before they need to deploy their monetary weapons once more. So the big bet on continued advances is going to be very much centered on fiscal stimulus. And we've definitely seen that fiscal stimulus is becoming a lot more fashionable, and that needs to persist if it's going to provide the kind of liquidity necessary for these expansions to continue. I think what I'd like to finish by is looking at the yield curve spread, because it is now at 17 basis points. We've definitely had a hiatus in terms of the decline, but it's still trending down. And there have been some meaningful ranges within this downtrend, and they've generally lasted anything from 2 to 4 months, and this one is just about 2 months. But the sequence of lower rally highs remains intact. It does look likely that this part of the yield curve is going to invert. There are lots of other parts of the yield curve have already inverted, and the tips curve inverted about 6 months ago. So we know that liquidity conditions are tightening, and that's a significant issue. So that's the big difference now between what we had in 2011 and 2015-16. Because in 2011 we got QE2, and in 2015 and 2016 we got the ECB's massive liquidity injections. And right now you have China is weighing on the shadow banking sector and is reluctant to go back into stimulus. Japan can't do it all on its own. The ECB has ended its quantitative easing program, and the USA is actively reducing the size of its balance sheet. So the really big question out there on the horizon is, where is the liquidity going to come from? We had the big move in share buybacks in 2017 that priced in all of the buybacks that were due to occur in 2018. Now I think it's more than reasonable to conclude that the volatility we've had over the last few months is more in response to the potential that we're not going to have the same sources of liquidity supporting the market in future that we've had in the past. So we're going to have a much more volatile environment, but that's of course before we get an economic contraction. And when we do get an inverted yield curve, well, then we're probably anything from 6 to 18 months out. This is, I think, the time to be most clearly paying attention to the consistency of trends. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.